Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Monday, the 14th of October, these are our main stories. As the Turkish offensive against the Kurds intensifies, Washington announces it's to withdraw the remaining U.S. troops there. Relief operations are underway in Japan as Typhoon Hagibis, which has claimed the lives of more than 30 people, causes severe flooding in the country. Also in this podcast, the backlash against e-cigarettes and their effect on children grows in the U.S.
We came together very quickly because this is a race against time. You know, this vaping epidemic is the most serious adolescent public health crisis our country has faced in decades.
And California becomes the first U.S. state to ban fur, though with some exemptions. We begin this podcast with Sunday's dramatic developments in northern Syria. First, the Americans announced a withdrawal of all their remaining troops from the area less than a week after the partial retreat that prompted Turkey to launch its offensive against Kurdish fighters. We'll have more on that in a moment. But a few hours later came news that the Kurds had struck a deal with the government in Damascus. It'll mean the Syrian army deploys along the border to try to stop the Turkish offensive. So why have the Kurds agreed to this now? A question for our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
Well, I guess essentially they have run out of options, they run out of choices. The US were providing them with protection simply by being there, not in force, but as long as the US troops were in that region, Turkey was unlikely to invade. Obviously, once they were going to pull out, that opened the way for Turkey. We've heard since the Turkish offensive got underway 5 days ago, we've heard just today that the US troops are going to be moving out even more abruptly than had been anticipated. So things have moved very quickly. There have been talks, there have been negotiations going on between the Kurds in the north with the government in Damascus, presumably with Russian involvement as well for some time. We know that those talks have escalated in the last few days, and now a deal has been done. What the Kurds are saying is that this is to protect the border region against the Turkish invasion. For the Kurds, who've never been in direct conflict with the Syrian army, it's not as big a deal as it was, of course, for fighters in rebel areas, in rebel cities like Aleppo or Homs, where essentially they were a defeated force and retribution was expected once they were forced out. The Kurds and the Kurds in the regions they control won't necessarily expect any great consequences in terms of retribution from the Syrian government if they go in. But on a wider scale, of course, this could pit Turkey against the Syrian government. It also means the Syrian government will almost have to be dealt with by international forces, by the West, which for years, of course, were saying President Assad must fall. If the Syrian government is in place in these key strategic areas, if, as the Kurds have suggested, they're handing over the IS prisoners they have to the government, this means that the West has got to deal with President Assad directly.
Sebastian Usher. Well, let's turn now to the U.S. troop withdrawal and announcing it on CBS News. The Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, said the Turkish offensive had left the U.S. military no other choice.
Despite our opposition, they decided to make this incursion into Syria. And at this point in time, in the last 24 hours, we learned that they likely intend to expand their attack further south than originally planned and to the west. We also have learned in the last 24 hours that the Kurdish forces, the SDF, are looking to cut a deal, if you will, with the Syrians and the Russians to counterattack against the Turks in the north. And so what we find ourselves is we have American forces likely caught between two opposing advancing armies, and it's a very untenable situation.
Mark Esper, I've been speaking to our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler. He says American officials are increasingly worried about the unfolding developments in northern Syria.
Yeah, I was looking back at the statement there that came from the White House last week, whenever they said that Turkey were planning this, what they described as a long-planned operation to go into northern Syria. And at that stage, the US essentially was washing its hands of it, saying that, you know, as far as it was concerned, it had defeated the Islamic State group. It wasn't going to be involved, but it essentially allowed Turkey to go ahead with this operation. Now, since then, we have seen the State Department and the Pentagon become increasingly concerned by what they're saying. They also feel that President Trump has perhaps not been hard enough in trying to strike back at Turkey, saying you've got to restrain yourselves in what you're doing. And certainly if you listen to the US Defense Secretary Mark Esper today, he was saying that he believes Turkey is looking to go further south than they had planned. And certainly there is a great deal of nervousness as they watch the chaos and the conflict from afar, not least because the Kurdish forces that are involved in this and are being attacked by Turkey used to be US allies. And ultimately, they do feel abandoned.
But President Trump seems rather pleased with the decision still. He's tweeted, "It's very smart not to be involved in the intense fighting along the Turkish border for a change. Those that mistakenly got us into the Middle East wars," he says, "are still pushing to fight and they have no idea what a bad decision they have made." So he still seems like he's pushing on with this idea. But is there growing political opposition in Washington towards this?
A president that believes in America first has never wanted to be inside the Middle East. He doesn't want to be involved in these drawn-out conflicts and doesn't think that there is a merit to it. Those in Washington feel quite differently, including some Trump loyalists, some inside Congress who normally stand alongside the president when he sometimes makes decisions that other people find uncomfortable. And that is for two reasons. First of all, there is a question of being smart and also a question of honour. They feel that they do have a responsibility to the Kurds who did work with them in tackling IS. Beyond that, there is also the concerns about Islamic State going forward. They are watching the chaos amid this conflict and seeing there is a danger of some people who are within the Islamic State group who have been captured being released amid all of this, and potentially that group emerging as a threat again. And it includes some very influential people, including a former US Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who was speaking this morning.
Chris Buckler in Washington. More than 30 people have died in Japan as a result of Typhoon Hagibis, and many more are missing. More than 100,000 emergency workers, including soldiers, have been deployed across the country and are working around the clock. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the government will do its best to get the country back on its feet.
I pray for the souls of those who lost their lives and for the well-being of everyone affected by the storm. As well as personnel from the police, the fire department and the Coast Guard, we've deployed 27,000 self-defense force members for search and rescue operations. The typhoon has caused the suspension of electricity, water and transportation services, affecting people's lives. The government will do its utmost to resume these as soon as possible.
These people told the BBC about their experiences in the storm.
I have lived here 32 years. It is the first time I have seen anything like this. I was shaking with fear last night.
I watched the live camera of the river and I could see it coming up and up, getting closer and closer to the top. I never thought something like this would happen in my neighbourhood. I was so surprised.
Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes sent this report from Kawagoe City, north of Tokyo.
The town worst hit by Typhoon Hagibis isn't on the coast of Japan, but 100 miles inland in the Japanese Alps. On Saturday night, the levees in the town of Chikuma burst, unable to withstand the onslaught from the typhoon rains. All day, military helicopters have been plucking people from the roofs of their homes. North of Tokyo, the city of Kawagoe has also been hard hit. You can hear me wading through the water here. This, where I'm standing yesterday, would have been a field. Now it is a vast expanse of brown, murky floodwaters. Beside me here is a half-submerged tractor. And in the distance, there is a large old people's home that is now completely stranded, surrounded by the floodwaters. The really extraordinary thing about this typhoon is its scale. There are rescue operations going on in at least 8 different prefectures across the main island of Japan. Japan is also starting to count the economic cost of this single storm. Outside the city of Nagano, a row of five shiny bullet trains stands swamped by the floodwaters. Each one costs $29 million.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. To the United States now, where more questions are being asked about vaping after a spate of health problems related to e-cigarettes. So far, there have been 18 reported deaths connected to the use of smoking substitute devices, and thousands more have been adversely affected. It's not entirely clear what the cause is, but now parents and politicians are leading the backlash. Ben Wright has been following the story.
Last month, the state imposed an emergency 90-day ban on the sale of all flavoured e-cigarettes. Enforcement has been delayed by legal wrangling, but it's likely to be a short-lived breather for the city's vape stores.
Spike Babain serves one of her customers at her vape shop in East Harlem.
Way better than cigarettes.
Yes.
Way better.
Spike is certain a crackdown on vaping will send former smokers back to cigarettes.
80% or more of the people that come into a vape shop have already tried to quit smoking using nicotine patch and nicotine gum and hypnosis. And when every other method fails, that's when they come here.
But the e-cigarette industry here is under intense pressure. A mystery lung ailment has made more than 1,000 vape users ill. And there is huge concern about the number of US school children now using e-cigarettes. New York is not banning all vaping products, only non-tobacco flavored e-liquids and pods.
I'm Mark Levine, City Council member from Northern Manhattan, chair of the City Council's Health Committee, and we're here in a community office in Harlem. This is not a prohibition. This is only getting the flavors off the shelves. There's no doubt that flavors hook kids.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, publishes weekly figures showing the number of vaping-related illnesses continuing to climb. The CDC says the specific cause of these illnesses isn't known, but has advised people to avoid all vaping products.
I'm Oxides Barbeau, and I'm the health commissioner for New York City. So there's uncertainty in e-cigarettes on two fronts. One is the degree to which noxious toxic chemicals get liberated in the vapor and affect lung capacity. The second one is there is mixed evidence about the efficacy of e-cigarettes given their high concentration of nicotine as effective cessation devices in the United States.
We have no idea, really, what millions of kids have been pulling deep into their developing lungs.
18 months ago, Meredith Berkman and two other mothers co-founded Parents Against Vaping e-cigarettes.
We came together very quickly because this is a race against time. You know, this vaping epidemic is the most serious adolescent public health crisis our country has faced in decades.
Which is why Congress is holding hearings and why the e-cigarette industry is facing intense scrutiny. Council member Mark Levine again.
The fact that this issue has gone national and international reflects a remarkable public health victory for advocates who've been fighting in the wilderness for years on this.
In the US at least, vaping and e-cigarettes are no longer seen as benign alternatives to tobacco, and even the manufacturers accept the long-term effects are unknown.
That report from Ben Wright. The Chinese President Xi Jinping has issued a strong warning against dissent as anti-Beijing protests continue in Hong Kong. State media quoted Mr. Xi as saying that those who tried to divide China risked crushed bodies and shattered bones. Here's Will Leonardo.
Since the anti-government protests began in Hong Kong 4 months ago, the police have been accused of using brutal tactics to disperse them. Mr. Xi's comments evoking broken bodies won't go down well with the hundreds of people who've been injured by batons, tear gas and rubber bullets. X-rays of broken bones allegedly sustained in police custody were plastered to the ground at one rally on Saturday. Sunday's protests have turned violent again. Pro-Beijing businesses were attacked and one police officer was slashed in the neck. With trust between the two sides at rock bottom, the latest remarks from the Chinese leader will sound ominous to many in Hong Kong.
The Kenyan runner Brigid Kosgei has set a new world record for the women's marathon, easily beating a record that stood for 16 years. It was set by the British athlete Paula Radcliffe. Dan Rowan has more.
For more than 16 years, Paula Radcliffe's world marathon record has proved unbeatable. But in perfect conditions in Chicago, it was not so much surpassed, but smashed by an astonishing 81 seconds as Brigid Kosgei made history with a time of 2:14.04. To put the dominance of her performance into perspective, she was almost 7 minutes quicker than her nearest rival. Having seen her record fall, Radcliffe was at the finish line to congratulate the 25-year-old Kenyan, whose compatriot Lawrence Chirono won the men's race. Last year's champion Mo Farah produced his worst ever marathon time, finishing back in eighth and more than 4 minutes adrift on what proved a day to forget for Britain's two greatest distance runners. Yesterday in Vienna, Eliud Kipchoge became the first athlete to run a marathon distance in under 2 hours. Unlike that feat, Koskaj's was in open competition and will count as an official world record, capping a momentous weekend for the sport.
Dan Rowan. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Dr. Ruja promised to make the world rich.
We create the world around this coin.
Her company made billions from global investors.
She called herself the Crypto Queen.
And then, 2 years ago, she disappeared.
How can this happen?
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as I search for Dr. Ruja and the truth about her company, OneCoin.
Kidnapping, killing.
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
The Missing Crypto Queen. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
And still to come in this podcast, we hear from the author Sir Salman Rushdie, who's earned his fifth nomination for the shortlist of the Booker Prize with his new novel. Could bananas soon be extinct? The Cavendish breed of the fruit, which counts for half of global production, has been threatened by a fungus called Tropical Race 4, which has been spreading around the world for decades, but it has now reached Latin America. Colombia is the world's fourth largest banana exporter, and most are shipped to Europe. Reporter Victoria Stunt has been speaking to local farmers to find out what the risks are and what they're doing to protect themselves and their crops.
There are strict security measures needed to enter Fabian Sierra's banana farm. First, to switch into tall rubber boots. Then, to stand in a tub filled with cleaning solution until he gives you the okay to step out. They're to protect against a fungus called Tropical Race 4, which has been tearing through large banana farms nearby in La Guajira, a Colombian department that shares a border with Venezuela. Fabian is a small producer and his farm is over 2 hours away in Magdalena, but Tropical Race 4 has caused a national emergency, and he's worried it could continue to spread.
As a small producer, what we can do is avoid the fungus entering the farm.
Freddy Rodriguez Cantillo is another banana farmer in the region who leads a local banana cooperative. He's nervous about what might happen.
If it arrives in Magdalena, we run the risk of losing our farms because this disease stays in the ground for more than 30 years.
At the 6 farms hit by the fungus in La Guajira, the plants had turned brown and wilted. They're currently under quarantine, and so far, 432 acres, that's the size of more than 325 football fields, have been uprooted. The fungus is spread through infected plants, water, or dirt carried long distances on shoes, clothes, farm tools, or vehicles. I'm standing on the side of the road at a Colombian Agricultural Institute control point, set up to pull over trucks carrying bananas. An employee from the institute, who is wearing a blue suit and a face mask, is going around to each wheel on the trucks to spray sanitizer and to reduce the chances of the fungus spreading. But despite the biosecurity measures being carried out throughout the banana-growing regions of Colombia, there are fears it could have moved already.
Hola.
According to Ana Maria Garcia, who manages the Colombian Agricultural Institute's laboratory in Bogota, the discovery of Tropical Race 4 was saddening, but it's something they'd prepared for.
I understood many years ago the importance and the implication the arrival of this pathogen had on the American continent. But since the beginning, and since day zero when we saw in the laboratory this could potentially be Fusarium oxysporum tropical race 4, we acted as if it were present, to avoid it spreading and reduce the risk that existed for the other regions. Banana exports in Colombia were worth more than 700 million pounds in 2018, with more than 80% of bananas being shipped to Europe. These were Cavendish bananas, which are the standard around the world. With the fungus now in Colombia, the country will likely need to find a new variety that's resistant or tolerant to the disease, which could take years. Back at Fabian's banana farm, we're speaking together from under a canopy of healthy green banana plants. He tells me it's still business as usual, despite this new threat.
The farm will continue operating in the same way. It's praying to God that it doesn't arrive here. Not just mine, but everyone's farm.
Victoria Stunt reporting from Colombia. Next, to the Vatican. History was made there on Sunday as Pope Francis canonized five new saints whose lives spanned several centuries and continents. Four of them are women, including a Brazilian nun, the first female saint from that country, while the solitary new male saint, the theologian John Henry Newman, is the first Englishman to be canonized since the 17th century. This was the moment when Pope Francis read out the names of the five new saints.
Beatus Ioannem Enrico Newman, Josefina Banini, Maria Theresia Charmel Mankidijan, Dulcem Lopez Pontes et Margarita Mbais, Sanctus esse de Cernibus et Definimus, ac Sanctorum Catalogo ascribimus, statuet in seu in Universa Ecclesia inter Santos pia devotioni reculi deveri in nomine Patris et Filio et Spiritus Sancti.
Amen. Pope Francis there. Dr. Janina Ramirez is a cultural historian and the author of The Private Lives of the Saints. How significant are today's canonizations?
I know it seems like such a medieval thing to do, to get excited about the canonization of saints, but each of these people and the effect that their canonization is going to have in their native lands, they're very, very important, so much so that Sister Dulce, the Brazilian saint, in the process of her being canonized, Brazil have actually stopped some of their social bills going through. It's such a big deal nationally that it's having a huge impact throughout the country. What's really exciting, I think, for me is this year we have a first English saint for a very long time, John Henry Newman, but also four women. And each of the stories that these women's lives reveal are fascinating because they've all lived through hardship, physical suffering, and all of them have done something to help the sick, the poor, and the needy. So we're really seeing this as something that the Catholic Church are trying to celebrate. John Henry Newman is a really very important saint through the Victorian period. He was a poet, a philosopher, theologian. He started the Oxford movement, which saw the Church of England and the Catholic Church find a sort of middle way where they reconciled aspects of each of the churches to find something that was much more like we think of the High Church of England today. And then you've got, as I mentioned, Sister Dulce, the Brazilian saint. She was born in 1914 and she was nominated for a Nobel Prize. Really, I think her importance is the things she did in terms of working with the poor. Saints are often the brilliant people of their time, the sort of the celebrities of their time. And they give us a window back to the past, but they also tell us the sorts of virtues that are being celebrated now.
Dr. Janina Ramirez. California has become the first U.S. state to ban the manufacture and sale of animal fur. The move has been welcomed by animal rights groups. Our reporter, Gareth Barlow, has been following the story.
The bill was signed into law by the governor, Gary Newsom, and this means California has the first statewide ban on fur products in America. It follows similar moves by the cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles. And what it means is that from 2023, it'll be illegal to sell or make clothes, shoes and handbags made out of fur. Let's hear from Laura Friedman. She's a politician in the California Assembly. She's the author of the bill and explains, though, there are some exemptions.
It allows leather, cowhide, shearling, which is made from sheep, goat fur, because these are primarily animals that are being raised and slaughtered for food, and the fur is a byproduct of that food production. We also have quite a rigorous way of regulating the conditions in the United States those animals are raised in and how they're slaughtered. That's not the case with the exotic furs that this bill is really targeting.
If people break the law, they will incur a $500 to $1,000 fine, although there are exceptions for religious and tribal purposes. The decision has been criticised by the Fur Information Council. Their spokesperson said it was part of a radical vegan agenda that was using fur as the first step to other bans on what people may be able to wear and eat. But it has been welcomed by activists, and this follows a wider trend that we're seeing around the world. Fashion labels, some of the top fashion labels, saying they were either going to stop or are planning to stop using fur in their clothing ranges. And now other regions throughout America are also exploring to do the same. So we may well see other cities, other states employing similar bans.
Gareth Barlow. Later on Monday, the winner of this year's Booker Prize will be announced here in London. Six people are on the shortlist for one of the world's most prestigious literary awards. One of them is Sir Salman Rushdie, who's earned his fifth shortlist nomination with his new novel, Quixote, having previously won the prize in 1981. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd spoke to him.
Salman Rushdie is winner of a previous Booker Prize, of the 1993 Booker of Bookers Award and the 2008 Best of Booker. But at home in Manhattan, he's been watching a lot of trash TV. It was all research in aid of his new 15th novel, Quixote.
Since I have a character whose mind is being poisoned by reality TV, I had to do my due diligence. So I actually did watch really upsetting quantities of Real Housewives and Kardashians and Bachelors and Bachelorettes. I think of the Real Housewives, the ones from Atlanta are the most enjoyable.
Now I want you to be happy.
Thank you.
I do not care.
All I'm saying is the joke in the spiritual temple.
It was not a joke.
The Booker-nominated Quixote tells a story based on Don Quixote. Sam Duchamp is a hack writer writing about Ismail's Smile, or Quixote. He is an Indian-American pharmaceutical sales rep who falls in love with a TV star and drives across America to find her in New York, the city the authors called home for 20 years. So is Rushdie now a New Yorker or still, deep down, an Indian?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of us Indians in New York, you know. I've always identified with cities in a way more than with countries, you know, so I feel very much a sense of belonging in Bombay, which I still call that, and in London and in New York. They're all places where I feel I have very deep roots.
In Quixote, to what extent is Sam Duchamp you, and to what extent is Ismail Smile you?
They both have a backstory in exactly the same small neighborhood of Bombay where I grew up. They're both people of approximately my age and wrestling with questions of mortality. Quixote actually has something which I deliberately used a quality of mine, which is a kind of stupid optimism. I find it very difficult to despair. So he's a kind of exaggerated version of me in that regard. And his ostensible author, Sam, well, I'm not somebody who spent my life writing second-rate spy novels, although I've always kind of wanted to write a spy novel.
Were you trying to give a big, as it were, cinemascope picture of America?
It's interesting that you say cinemascope because I use that kind of film metaphor all the time to myself. Even while I was writing the previous novel, The Golden House, I was saying to myself, next time you have to get out of the 212 area code and explore this huge and varied and problematic country. It's an attempt to write about old age, but facing what kind of life you've led and discovering in that old age a last access of crazy, improbable love and believing that that love will find a way. So it's a book about optimism. It's a book about being determined to have your last chance. What I feel is that when reality becomes as strange as it has become, when it becomes a kind of unreality, you can't go on writing classically realist novels to describe a very unclassical and unrealist world.
The novelist Salman Rushdie speaking there to Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.